3CR's Turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
Long before the 1993 United Nations landmark Declaration on Violence Against Women, Australia had witnessed substantial legal reforms, public awareness campaigns, and the introduction of support services for victims of violence. Since the early 1980s, all Australian states and territories have progressively introduced legislative reforms, led for the most part by continuous lobbying from feminists who worked hard to challenge the sexist notions embedded in the law. Law reform in one of the most horrific forms of violence against women, rape, has a checkered history in Australia. 1981 reforms in New South Wales remodelled the offence of rape as sexual assault in order to reflect the violent rather than the sexual nature of the offence. 9 years later, in 1990, Victoria's then Attorney General, Jim Cannon, introduced reforms on that state's rape law. Many women's groups felt these changes didn't go far enough. Meredith Carter from the Women's Legal Resource Group.
We keep getting told that there's an increasing number of complaints being received by the police of women being raped, but we don't see it being matched by an increase in the number of convictions. And we think that that's basically because the current definition of the law of rape doesn't reflect women's experience. And in particular, the focus on consent is a real problem in that we think that rapists really aren't very interested in whether or not a woman is consenting to sexual intercourse when he forces his attentions on her. And that focus in a court case deflects attention from what he said and did. It's particularly the case because the woman is the main witness. The accused doesn't, and we don't say he should, but the accused doesn't have to give any evidence. So the whole focus is on the woman's evidence, and from that you try to extrapolate what the accused thought about, what she thought about, what he was doing and thinking. He just has to have an honest belief that essentially that his attentions were welcome. So he doesn't have to have any basis for his belief that the woman wants to have sexual intercourse. It's enough that he honestly believes it. So, for example, there's the famous case, I think it's Morgan's case, where the husband told his mates that his wife liked sex rough, and so if she screamed and yelled and said no, that was really just because she was a bit kinky, and all of those men were acquitted.
A significant part of Victorian reforms related to consent, defining it for the purposes of rape and other sexual offences as free agreement. A case in the Supreme Court where several women consented to a medical procedure but later charged their radiologist with rape tested this notion.
The Supreme Court said, well, these women consented to the radiographer inserting medical instruments into their vaginas, therefore it wasn't rape, even though he got a thrill from it. But they consented because they thought he was performing a proper and necessary medical procedure. In fact, the procedure was neither proper or necessary, and he was doing it solely for the purpose of getting a thrill. So what, in fact, did they consent to? And that's the question that's now gone to the High Court, but we think that that should be clarified in the law, and we don't think that the current amendments will do that.
Meredith Carter from the Women's Legal Resource Group in 1990, talking about the Victorian rape law reforms that didn't quite go far enough on the issue of consent. Rape laws have continued to be a sticking point for many women's groups, and in 2004, a group called Campaign Against Rape was formed to call for further reforms to the laws.
It started when all of the allegations about the footballers and the rugby players started getting into the media. Firstly, the football clubs rallied around the men that were accused, and secondly, those cases, in most cases, haven't gone to court. There's one recently in South Australia that's gone to court, but on the whole, they get knocked out of the system. There are studies that have shown that lots of police don't believe that when women allege rape that they're telling the truth. There's also the Director of Public Prosecutions who decides sort of peremptorily that a case is not going to make it and doesn't give that case a chance to go to the juries. There are three women that alleged sexual molestation, and in all cases the DPP decided not to go ahead because they'd been ill-advised. It was based on stereotypes about women, stereotypes about sexual abuse, and those things would get thrashed out in a court, and they don't get thrashed out in that process. So we're saying they need to go to court so we can see all of the evidence and that argument can be had, and women who want to have their day in court should be able to. In the Queen's District of New York, all cases where a woman's willing to testify go to court, and they have an 80% prosecution rate. So I think that juries are more willing to believe women than perhaps the DPP thinks, and I think we need to be open to that and put it before a jury.
Rose Kitching from the Campaign Against Rape in 2004. On top of experiencing violence, many women are subjected to victimisation through the legal system that sets out to protect them. Women at a support group in Casa House, the Centre Against Sexual Assault in Melbourne, discussed their experiences in 1991 with the legal system.
I was really disheartened with what was going on because you read in the papers about how unjust the whole system is and how women will, you know, take a man to court and they've got all this evidence yet they'll still get off, or they'll get off in a good behaviour bond. So I just couldn't see that reporting it to the police would really make me feel any better, and the people that did it, I mean, what would they get? Nothing.
It was a rather awful experience because we were both fairly well educated. I mean, he was a teacher and I was a teacher too. It seemed to me that it was a general assumption that nice, respectable people, first of all, don't get themselves involved in situations such as sexual assault or domestic violence, which is my experience, and that's something confined to the so-called lower orders. The whole thing was twisted around rather nicely and neatly. In my case, I remember standing up in the courtroom because I was a witness in the case for the police, because the police were prosecuting. And I remember one of the first things his barrister said to me when he was cross-questioning me was to say, well, miss, you are a teacher, is that correct? And I said, yes, a secondary school teacher, yes. You teach English? I replied in the affirmative, naturally, and he said, well, I'd like to suggest to you that the whole thing was a fantasy, a fiction that you'd somehow constructed in your own mind. And I was extremely angry about the assumption that just because I taught English and dealt with works of fiction that I was suddenly somehow fictionalising this whole experience that had happened to me. I've never felt so angry before in my life. And there were people listening to me, people in court who'd never met me before listening to me, which I found really upsetting too. They were getting a distorted picture of me. It was like I was having all my insides ripped out, put on public display so everybody could see and judge. And then, of course, he stood there in his nice three-piece suit, looking terribly respectable, trying to tell everybody that I was the alcoholic and that I virtually deserved to have had what happened to me happen, you know? That he was somehow justified in beating me practically after death. That was okay for him to do that because he's nice and respectable. I was most disappointed in it because he was only given a fine for something which is a fairly major thing and has changed my life completely. I'm really disappointed in the whole legal system, and I can understand now why women do not go to the police for any reason, ranging from just a bit of a slap around, as men like to call it, to something like rape.
Muffled sound of fist on flesh, blows to chest, no breath, air gasps. You ain't nothing but white trash, bitch. With each hit, each kick, each broken rib, crack, crack, bones are crying. Mommy's crying and bleeding and pleading, and then daddy wants to fuck. Dick hard, swelled with power rush. And as if all that wasn't enough, mommy's 7 months heavy with birth as daddy grunts and curse, drunk nothings in her bloodied ear. First lullaby, first son we'll ever hear and never forget. Mommy almost bled to death when she have him, finally. She'd already lost three, uterus bruised, shredded and weak from being daily beat.
My counselling records, when I had gone to a counsellor, my medical records from a general practitioner, my crimes compensation records, and my work records and school records that they tried to find. All of those were subpoenaed. They were used in varying forms against me in court to either show that supposedly that I was unbalanced, which struck me as very strange. There was nothing there to indicate that, but they tried to say the fact that I needed to go to a counsellor was evidence enough to show that I was unstable. And evidence of going to a general practitioner with problems with sleep and problems, nightmares, that was used to show that I had some kind of mental disturbance. I was actually referred to as having mental problems, although no evidence could be proffered, and I found that terribly offensive. One of the worst things is that you feel that you're already on trial, but when they use selective areas of counselling records, the very essence of you as a person is being attacked. The very private things you told a counsellor about, the horrific things that the perpetrator did, in my case, your father, which is even worse, and that the perpetrator is there reading your files. That's just like being re-raped all over again within the legal system. It was horrific. It was dreadful. It was humiliating in the most extreme sense.
Women often suffered further trauma in court when the accused person's lawyer sought access to information about counselling or medical treatment that a woman may have received either prior to or following an assault. In 1998, legislation was enacted in Victoria to restrict the use of confidential communications between complainants and their counsellors as evidence in sexual offence trials.
The threshold test that will be operational in Victoria has three aspects to it. The first one is that the defence barrister, as it will usually be, will have to establish that the information in the file has substantial probative value, what's called substantial probative value. And the court, that is the magistrate or judge, will need to be satisfied on the balance of probabilities, not the criminal standard of beyond reasonable doubt. The court also has to be satisfied that there's no other place in which this evidence could come from, and that's unlikely given that this information is fairly unique to the counselling context. We don't think that barristers will have much trouble meeting either of those tests. The third test that the court must have consideration to is the public interest in sexual assault victim survivors having their file information protected. So the public interest in wanting to ensure that women continue to report these crimes, the public interest in assuring those women that they will have access to confidential counselling relationships. So they must have regard to that. They also have to have regard to the specific harm that's going to be caused to that woman in those circumstances to have the file admitted or information from the file admitted. Now that sounds like a fairly strong test, except that we know from the way in which legislation is being implemented or has been implemented in the past that judges, even having regard to those three tests, will still look to how that might influence the rights of the accused. And if they believe that that issue or the possibility of that information in the file is likely to have an impact on the case for him, for the accused, that it has quite a strong bearing on the case, they will allow it. I mean, the judges and magistrates have, certainly in the majority of instances, will want to keep the court open to allow accused people to mount the best defence that they can. And that goes back to those sort of old legal principles, I suppose, of ensuring that accused people have access to everything that they can to put up a defence. And the file, I think, will be used in that context. Even though this is meant to be a statutory privilege, to establish whether or not those threshold tests can be met, a judge or magistrate is going to have access to the file. So at least one person, even if, you know, just from an application being made, is going to have access to that file, and that will be absolutely devastating to women. Just at that very first step, if the magistrate or judge actually allows the file, then juries are going to hear what's in it. Defence barristers are going to have access to undermine her in some way, or to put it to her, question her about it in cross-examination. We're most concerned about women victim survivors having to be faced with questions about that counselling relationship and about that counselling context. Women are accessing counselling now more than they have in the past. They're reporting sexual assault more than they have in the past. We know that must be because of the fact that sexual assault services across the state of Victoria exist, and that they have been able to do that without being concerned or anxious about that information going any further.
You're listening to 3CR's 40 Days of Radical Radio special, celebrating 3CR's 40 fabulous years of community radio.
When I first started, I was working as the women's coordinator at the station, and I was the first women's coordinator. And also my role was to establish a national women's program, which became Women on the Line, which is also celebrating a birthday this year.
So I had a lovely 10 years involvement with the station. Really strong memories of lots of our International Women's Day broadcasting. I suppose because Women on the Line was a relatively new show then, when I started, there was a lot of energy and enthusiasm around it. There was a very strong women's collective that got together and organised special programming and stuff. And that, to me, I mean, personally, I suppose, was really important and useful.
I suppose the other aspect of fear and anxiety that would be caused to a woman who may have her file revealed to the court is that she may feel that the accused himself is going to have access to it. And that could happen. I mean, that has happened in the past. It certainly could happen that her file is seen by him. Now, that, I mean, I just cannot imagine how destructive that will be to her in terms of any healing process that she's engaging with or undertaking at that time. It may prevent her from going ahead with any court proceedings at all. And I've certainly known of instances where women being faced with that proposition, that perhaps the prosecutor has said to them, look, your file's been subpoenaed, it's a possibility that it might be available to the court, that they have needed to ask, the prosecutors have then needed to ask for an adjournment because the woman has been saying, I'm not going to go through with this. There is no way I'm going to give evidence at this trial if that's going to happen. So it's absolutely destructive for her, and it's absolutely destructive for a criminal justice system that says that it's got, you know, that it actually has the protection of its members, community members, at the pinnacle of what, you know, its existence. One of the most common defences that's still operating in sexual assault court proceedings in the criminal jurisdictions, that is that, you know, you've made it up, or, you know, you've made up at least aspects of this, and therefore follows that you were really consenting or something like that. That's the usual defence, I suppose. Now, in that context, they will look to that threshold test that's being provided for by the legislation and say, well, we say that there's a possibility that this woman may have talked to a counsellor about making a false complaint, or in fact that she's talked about this incident to her counsellor, and therefore she's still making false complaints to others now, to her counsellor. And that is allowed for by the legislation, that if the defence barrister can show that there's a possibility that this claim may be false, and that she's continuing to make false claims, i.e. in a counselling context, and that's another reason why a file might be admitted. The only evidence, in inverted commas, that a defence barrister might have is that that's their defence, that she's making it up. And in the studies that I've done in the past on Victorian trials, that is a very common defence.
Melanie Heenan from Casa House in Melbourne in 1998. In 2006, the Victorian Crime Sexual Offences Act went further to restrict confidential communications between counsellors and their clients from being admitted to court. Tasmania has also enacted similar legislation. Around Australia through the Community Radio Network, you're listening to a special Women on the Line presentation on the record, an eight-part series chronicling key feminist issues covered on the program since 1986. Until relatively recently, a man's use of violence towards a female partner was considered to be a private matter, one where police and law would not tread. Since 1987, the Crimes Family Violence Act has been used to address domestic violence within Victoria and was subject to a review in 2005. Judith Pearce, a commissioner with the Victorian Law Reform Commission, speaks about the review.
That inquiry leads us into the pathways of should family violence be treated essentially as a criminal offence, or should there be civil remedies that women can access fairly easily? Or should there be a combination of both? And the debate about criminalising family violence has been a debate that's engaged the women's movement for a very long time. Some communities such as Tasmania has recently decided to go down the path of making a special family violence offence, which is a criminal offence, and some retain the civil approach. And the argument is that if you don't criminalise it, you are again diminishing the effect of family violence. But lawyers understand and courts understand that criminalising a matter makes it much harder to obtain protection because it has to be proved at a certain standard beyond reasonable doubt, and you have to have evidence for a criminal charge in a court. Without that, and that can be the case because there is no evidence other than what the statements of the parties are, we've shown that it's quite difficult to get convictions for assault. There are two things that occur in Victoria at the moment. One is the ordinary charge of assault, which would cover anybody in the community. And we know that there are a low number of assault charges brought against men in family violence cases. The other remedy is to go to the court and get an order from the court that prevents that person from having further contact with you. And what our research showed last year is that that system is not working very well at all. And what we fear is that it will expose many more women and children to violence in their homes. The process of getting an order, although designed to be quite easy, is discretionary. So it's in the hands of various police officers, registrars and magistrates, and they interpret the woman's position, they interpret the situation, and they interpret the law somewhat differently. So some women find it a great system. They are supported by police, they get their order from the court, they find that they have protection, but many do not.
Domestic murder is the extreme end of a spectrum of domestic violence, and in over 70% of these cases, the offender is male. These men, who murdered their wives or partners, were often found guilty of manslaughter rather than murder through a defence of provocations. This law dates back to the 17th century and required men to prove that they were provoked into murdering in a jealous rage. Carmel Boyce in 1989.
By the time the case got to the Supreme Court, the tables had turned. My sister, the victim, was the person on trial. The defence set out to suggest that any reasonable man of similar age, sex and characteristics of the accused might murder in the heat of passion in similar circumstances. They set out to prove provocation. Christine, the victim, was not present to put her side of the story. As most of her story related to a previous history of domestic violence, violence which by its very nature is unseen and unwitnessed, it could not be admitted as evidence in court. On the other hand, the accused was able to give an unsworn statement to the court. Amidst frequent outbursts of sobbing, he fabricated an account of his life with my sister, her inability to cook meals he liked, to keep the house as he liked, and to fit his image of a perfect wife.
Last night I heard the screaming, loud voices behind the wall. Another sleepless night for me, it won't do no good to call the police. Always come late if they come at all. And when they arrive, they say they can't interfere with domestic affairs between a man and his wife. And as they walk out the door, the tears well up in her eyes.
When we look at the more recent and growing excuse used as provocation in wife and other women killings, it's clear that there is a differentiation between the rights of women and the rights of men. This most recent excuse is that the woman tells her husband or her man she no longer loves him and she's leaving him. The ludicrous position is then adopted under the law of provocation that a man has an excuse for killing a woman because she says the relationship is at an end. Although a number of the judges of the Supreme Court of Victoria have spoken out against the law of provocation as it currently stands, the law effectively proclaims under this nonsense excuse for woman killing that a woman must stay with a man, although we know that the risks in staying with him are enormous. The reality and rights lawyers and courts recognise is that of the person in power, the jailer, not the prisoner. And women are too often prisoners and the victims of love. That odd male-defined condition that justifies killing. That odd male-defined condition that leads courts to say and the papers to report cases of the man who killed the wife he loved. The tragic court story of the man who loved his wife so much he killed her. The judge who sentenced him yesterday to 3 days jail, but with a 6-month non-parole period, said, "My sympathy is clearly in your favour. Sam Smith, 37, of Penrith, stabbed his wife in the heart when she said she was leaving him. The court was told he drove his wife to hospital after he stabbed her and then surrendered to the police. His wife's threat to leave him had been the ultimate blow," said the judge, "and he had struck out in despair and frustration." The judge went on to say that jail was likely to punish not only the offender, but also his 3 children who had lost their mother. And how did they lose their mother? That euphemistic word that disguises the cause of the loss, a knife, a man wielding it, that man, their father, abusing their rights along with their mother's right to live, engaging not only in murderous conduct, but the most maliciously abusive conduct that can be inflicted on a child, the killing of her or his parent, the mother. Men have the power to kill. They indulge that power on their human possessions, and society gives them permission by failing to enunciate clearly and without demur that wife killing is murder, that wife killers are murderers, and that the murder that is wife killing is wrong.
Barrister and feminist Jocelyn Scott in 1989. In late 2005, the Victorian government announced a historic reform. Men who kill in jealous rages will no longer be able to avoid murder convictions by claiming they were provoked. Under a range of changes to the Crimes Act, a new defence of domestic homicide was introduced. Undoubtedly, changes to legislation and legal procedures have been integral to the fight for improved understanding of and official responses to violence against women. But the fact remains that violence against women still exists.
I don't think we should put all our eggs into the basket of the law. I think we should use the law and engage with the law and try and ensure that inequalities, particularly in relation to violence, are ameliorated, are responded to, are reduced. But we've also got to look much, much more broadly. Education in schools, education of young people. What I always say is law's not everything, but it's not nothing.
Lecturer in feminist legal theory and Deputy Dean of the Law School at the University of Melbourne, Jenny Morgan, in 2005. You've been listening to a special series on the record, 20 Years of Women's Radio, an 8-part series chronicling key feminist issues covered on the program since 1986.
The 3CR's turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.